the acknowledgement of guilt is a precondition, prerequisite for reparation. There is no reparation without the acknowledgement of guilt. And guilt arises when love and hatred come together toward the same person. There is no need to feel guilt as long as we idealize a good object, and there's no need to feel guilt as long as we hate the bad object. But when we discover that it is the same object and that our love feelings and our hatred are directed toward the same object, then guilt arises. It's more, I think, of guilt more as a molecule, not as an atom.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Heinz Weiss. Dr. Weiss has written an important new book called Trauma, Guilt, and Reparation: The Path from Impasse to Development. And we spend our time today unpacking what it means intrapsychically, developmentally, for someone to suffer terrible trauma, and how that lives throughout their life, and most importantly, how that takes shape between analyst and analysand, if the person's lucky enough to be in an analytic situation. And as one won't be surprised to learn, that much of the action takes place in the transference, countertransference, but of a different sort. It's not the usual comfortable analytic third that we may be familiar with less traumatized patients. It's in a very concrete way, because the patient's minds have been limited by their overwhelming trauma and the lack of safety and the need to be concrete and to be action-oriented and to be somatically focused is an essential survival mechanism that, unfortunately, they carry with them into their life and into the analysis. And it then becomes a challenge, of course, for how the analyst sits with it and works with it to the patient's benefit. It's a fascinating journey, and he describes it both theoretically and also clinically in a very alive way. You would never know that he's a thoughtful theoretician when he describes his clinical work. He is the head of the Department of Psychosomatic Medicine at the Robert Bosch Hospital in Stuttgart, Germany. He's also the head of the medical division and member of the directorate of the Sigmund Freud Institute, Frankfurt Mann, and the chair of the education section of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. Here is my conversation with Dr. Heinz Weiss. Heinz, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Heinz, I've read your book, Trauma, Guilt, and Reparation, The Path from Impasse to Development. I've actually read it twice. And I found it really important and valuable in ways that I think will come across in our conversation today. But as an overview, trauma is a term that has many meanings in many settings. Trauma is used in the common sense point of view, in the colloquial sense of that people say, oh, they were traumatized by something. And what they really mean, of course, is that they were discomforted by something. And they attribute the source of the discomfort outside of them, and they call that, I've been traumatized. In the clinical setting, trauma also has many meanings. Trauma can refer to adult onset trauma, where some calamity befalls us in adult life. It can refer to a childhood traumatic situation of an acute sort, where parents, let's say, are killed, or tornadoes blow down one's house one night. That's a traumatic situation. And then there's the kind that you focus on, which is, one way to put it would be that the child lives in a malignant place in the parent's mind, and their whole self-awareness is through that distorted parental unconscious registration. And that has calamitous implications in people's lives that you've write about so beautifully, both, and that's one of the pleasures of the book. It is both theoretically rich and clinically very alive, and we're going to get to both. But what you describe is when children are subjected to that kind of trauma, their mind doesn't have a safe place with which to flourish and to discover not only the world outside them, but their affective life inside them. And so instead of affects and symbolization and nuance and play space, what develops are affect precursors. Sensations replace affects, and somatization and action. And words lose their place quality, and they become literal representations of actions. And then if the person is lucky enough to find themselves in an analytic situation later in life, and we as the analyst do our best to engage all of them, we have no choice but to be swept up in that literal way of experiencing themselves. And you talk at length about that. It can be called a countertransference. It can be called many things, but it's certainly living in the concrete language of the patient. And I want to start us off by reading just a couple of sentences from your book, and then invite you to elaborate on your understanding of trauma. But what you write is the following. Quote, without noticing, the analyst begins to perceive, feel, and react as if he had become part of the patient's internal world. And it takes a while to emerge gradually out of this experience and to notice how caught up and ensnared they are. It is only when the analyst reawakens from his countertransference feelings that an observing stance can be recaptured and a return to symbolic thinking can take place. Well, that's quite a statement. Tell us about trauma, Heinz.
Thank you, Harvey. First, I want to say, to confirm what you said, that the term trauma has become fashionable and flattened in a way, a sort of a commonplace, I think. And I think it's exactly for this reason that we have to emphasize that psychoanalysis has to say more about what a traumatic experience is. And in a way, we could also say that the whole history of psychoanalysis is about the evolution of the concept of trauma. And to give a definition, I would return to Freud's definition in inhibition, symptom, and anxiety, where he says that it is the traumatic experience is characterized by the feelings of helplessness and impotence the individual is exposed to. And it seemed important to me that Freud puts the subjective experience into the foreground, not the external event. And of course, one can look at trauma from both sides, and Freud did it throughout the development of his theory. he started with the seduction theory of his hysterical patients, but soon he realized that was not all, and they had doubts about the reality of the patient's memories. And when he gave up the seduction theory, then he focused on unconscious fantasy as the main source of trauma. But throughout this work, there is this interplay between external and internal factors leading to what he called helplessness and impotence as the core of the traumatic experience. I would prefer to what you said to visualize it in a picture. You mentioned the tornadoes that you recently had.
Yes.
Where was it? In Kentucky or somewhere?
Yes.
Yeah, mainly in the Midwest. Or we could also, I like to visualize it by, you could also choose the image of a meteor strike. And that is the overpowering effect of an overwhelming reality. And which is experienced from inside, like the explosion of an unconscious fantasy. So, and perhaps it would be even more adequate to imagine that the effects of a traumatic experience as a series of meteor strikes or tornadoes that lead to the explosion of a volcano, resulting then in a sort of climate change, hunger and cold, which in turn leads to a long-lasting civil war, an internal warfare, as Melanie Klein called it. And it is this civil war, this internal civil war, which leaves the individual with a very damaging and damaged internal figures, which of course reemerge in the transference, and in particular in the counter transference.
How do you, just so I get clarity, you're describing the complemental series between the internal and external. Where does the parental unconscious life and its impact on the child fit into that schema?
I think that the patient lives in the parent's mind in a way.
Yeah.
So that is what Henry Ray called, that the psychological birth and biological birth are timely dissociated, and for a long while the patient is part, lives in the parents' or in the mother's internal world, and it's difficult for him to construct his own internal world. So he also inhabits, of course, the fantasy world, the unconscious fantasy of the parents, and without knowing them, of course. And in the clinical setting, we often make the experience that the patient knows all about our countertransference before we even can realize it. That was a very amazing experience that struck me. So in a way, those patients seem able to perceive something that we are not yet able to perceive in ourselves.
As they had to be hyper alert to the parental internal states?
Probably, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And it's difficult for them to disentangle from the internal world of the parents.
Yes.
But they, of course, they also project parts of their own internal world into the parents, and what they reintroject is a mixture from the parents' internal world and the part of their own self that they have projected into the patient, into the parents.
And that's when it becomes, we're jumping right into countertransference, and I think that's fine, because as you and many authors you quote make very clear, that is the crux of the work. That since the patients are working in a literal mindset, we have to be subjected to that as well. And you have a lovely phrase, I'll read it again, a different part, where you are referring to the possibility of remembering and the possibility of forgetting. And you write, quote, "Both are linked to the analyst's capacity to absorb and work with the damaged objects in a way that neither overwhelms him nor makes him push them back into the patient, finding them unbearable. Now, I think many of us know what you're referring to by the wish to push them back, but I've never seen that phrase used, and I think it really captures an inclination on the part of the clinician when badness is projected into you, and you feel overcome and defined by it. And the inclination is to want to get rid of it, like a child's game, the hot potato. And so you want to give it back to the patient without metabolizing it, which is obviously not always possible. But tell us about how you came to that and how it lives for you and how you understand it.
I need to explain this a little bit, but one of the main ideas I got from Roger Manicor on this early paper on normal countertransference and some of its deviations. That was from 56. And where he describes countertransference as a slow motion process, where the patient projects into us parts of his self. And these parts link up with our own unconscious internal objects. And he says that the projection of the patient's damaged internal figures come to stand for our own damaged inner figures. And if we cannot bear that, if we cannot tolerate this, then we either block and don't let the projections in, and then we become, so to say, impermeable for the patient's projection, or we get become overwhelmed by them, and then the tendency to project them back into the patient is strong. Therefore, he says the analyst has to develop a capacity to wait and to, he says at the point which I liked very much, he says, we then experience the fear of helplessness and insecurity inside us, and also a fear of the truth. And he said a good mind setting of the analyst is if he can tolerate the waiting period before he formulates an interpretation, and he can tolerate the fear of ignorance as well as the fear of truth. That I found very helpful, because we often do not realize the countertransference. And I also disagree with those authors who say that the countertransference only emerges from the patient's projections, because we have to take the responsibility for our countertransference feelings. Those are our own feelings, and we are not conscious about them. I think there are specific countertransference feelings, in particular in working with traumatized patients. One being described as the numbing feeling of reality, and that is, I think, we are so the concrete communications of the patients, which is beyond the words, and leads to leads us to be such preoccupied with the reality of trauma that we lose temporarily, at least, our capacity to symbolize it and to think about it. And we have to regain this capacity to formulate for ourselves that what the patients tell us, and which is so stuck inside our mind as a reality, as if the patients would have told us a dream. About a dream we could reflect, but not about reality. So that is the transformations from concrete communication into some sort of symbolic communication. But this needs time, because trauma is immediate, concrete, and timeless. And our analytic word is work is needs time, and time has to do with reparation and with symbolization.
You write again beautifully about time, and there are different meanings, of course, of time. There's the length of treatment. But of course, we've all known of long treatments where time doesn't pass intrapsychically, where it's the same at one moment as the next. And that is not engaging in the process you write about of reparation and mourning. That's the challenge. Separateness is something you write about as well, that too is part of a whole object type of relation. Let me just read another quote. Again, I've selected just a few. There are so many. You write about resentment. Now, we all know what resentment is in our own minds, and certainly we've experienced it in the office. And like many of these things, there are different levels of it. And you write, for as long as resentment can be maintained, control over the object does not have to be given up. It is exactly this constellation which makes the overcoming of resentment so difficult and painful, a very desperate situation which underlies the impossibility of reparation. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, I think as long as grievance or resentment is the predominant feeling of the patient, then the guilt is projected into somebody else. So we feel we resent people who have treated us unfairly, and we are right to do so to a certain degree, but to hold on resentment means that we don't leave the object off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And we blame the object for all the guilt. It is partially, of course, right. And we have, as long as we feel resentment, we have no need to make reparation. The wish for reparation is projected into the other person, and we demand reparation from him or from her. And of course, any attempt for reparation, it never really works, because any attempt of the object to make reparation is only seen as a new acknowledgement of his or her guilt. So that is the problem, that we get stuck into a process where reparation is very difficult, almost impossible, as long as there is no feeling of guilt that emerges inside the patient or inside us.
And if I understand you right, the one of the problems of resentment is that it's very clingy. The person who's resentful is often obsessed with the person they resent, and they're attached to them. And in a way, it spares them from really acknowledging the harm that may have been done to oneself. Because you're not seeing them as a full person, nor yourself as a full person who has been harmed. And so you can't hate properly if you're stuck in resentment. I don't know if that translates, but I think that's what you're saying. And I think that's true. You can hate a whole separate object, but you can resent and stay clung to a part object.
Yeah, well, I would absolutely agree to this, because if you can hate an object, then you can also you can also love the object. Wholeheartedly love the object. And I think our work, psychoanalytic work with traumatized patients, means that we must help them to hate the object, or what to really hate the object was has been bad in the past and is still bad. But also, if hatred can be made more open, then all the capacity for love reappears. And as you say, as long as grievance is a predominant feeling, so it's something you can neither hate nor love. And there was a German philosopher, Max Scheler, who said grievance is a poison for the human soul. Mm. And that I found very, very good description.
Grievance, resentment, poisonous.
You
have in this book a remarkable case and an intensive treatment that, again, one of the pleasures I had in reading it is that your theorizing is so rich, but it doesn't get in the way of your full-fledged encounter, personal encounter with the patient. So it's the best of theory that you can put it aside and just be present with the person. And I'm going to ask you to tell us about the patient, and I just want to quote her one sentence, which really sets the stage for your sharing with us. She said, quote, "There is something in me which is part of me and not part of me, which thinks that I only have a right to live if I feel bad." And with that as an introduction, tell us about Ms. E.
Yes. I will tell. Concerning theory, I must admit, first of all, that I don't like to see clinical material as a sort of demonstration of theory. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. E, in particular, is a patient of whom I have learned a lot about. I often felt that she knows much more about what I'm going to explore. And for instance, what you quote, the phrase that she said, "As long as I'm a bad person, I know, at least I know who I am." That's related to her guilt feelings, and that the badness gave her a feeling of identity. And actually, she reacted often confused when she was going to discover good sides in herself. And her history struck me, and she was a severely traumatized and neglected child. Her mother was delinquent and alcohol addict, and she had lent her from the age of 5 to the age of 11 to a circle of pedophile men who abused her. And when she came to analysis, she suffered from severe borderline symptoms, self-harm, eating disorders, confusional states, suicidal ruminations. And she came to analysis when her father had died, and she had married her husband, who obviously seemed to love her. And it is characteristic for her that her state had deteriorated exactly at this time, when she was unable to mourn the loss of her father and felt that she had not earned her husband's love. And as I learned in the course of Mrs. E's analysis, she had constructed from the age of 11 onwards a traumatic defense organization which dominated her daydreaming and which she called the Tower. And in this tower, in this imaginary sanctuary, the torturous and tormentors of her childhood had become, she said, her best friends. And as long as she would submit to their demands and their cruelty without complaint, she seemed protected from persecutory anxieties. And that was amazing, how the human mind was able to transform the traumatizing situation in a way into an idealized situation where the tormentors had become her best friends. The disadvantage was she had to pay a high price for it, because the illusory feeling of safety that the man in the tower provided obstructed any development. And now in the analysis, the conflict, a conflict of loyalty between the analysis and the man in the tower developed. And when she gradually moved out of her retreat, she was for a while threatened by chaos, confusion, and despair. And in this conflict, in relation to the powerful man in the tower, she saw me either as a weak, helpless figure who was forced to know all what went on in that tower, but was unable to intervene, or she saw me as a strict authority whose interpretations were seen as orders to which she was expected to obey. And that was extremely difficult for me, because I did not like to be such a helpless figure on the one hand, but I did not want to be such a cruel figure on the other hand.
Sure.
And I developed fantasies about being the only good person in her life, the one who could rescue from from this tormentor in the tower.
Let me ask you a question about that, because it struck me when I read it that you made interpretations that were based on your understanding of who she was at that moment, that emerged out of your analytic affection for her and helping her. And she didn't register it in that way. She took it as sadistic commands.
Yeah.
Now, it seems that that's sort of a checkmate moment where you're stuck because you're giving her the best of you and she collapses it into sadomasochism. And you say further that you have to tolerate that. What happened between the two of you? How did that become more nuanced, or did it? Was she able ever to receive the spirit of your interventions?
Yes. In the course of time, and already from the very beginning, she was very grateful for our work. On the one hand, she tended to idealize my mm-hmm. person. And on the other hand, she saw me as this powerful sadistic figure, and she had a fantasy of discipline, and she should obey. She found it a cruelty from my side that I did not answer her questions, but just interpret it, because she imagined that I knew how she should behave, what she should do in her life. And though I would leave it open, and however she reacted, it was wrong. And so she said, this is cruel. And I simply wanted to help her, but I had to understand that it was necessary that she experienced my interpretations as critique, as cruelty. And so I could not escape from this position, mm-hmm. and that she also could develop a capacity to be disappointed and sometimes even hate me for that, what I said. So, but that emerged in the course of time. And it was very difficult for me to acknowledge that she saw me also as a, on the one hand, as an idealized person, on the other hand, as a powerful, cruel person as well, who blamed her for all what she, because she was so addicted with her guilt feeling. I tried to liberate her from her guilt feeling, and she saw what I say is only pushing the guilt back into her. So we got into some sort of impasse. But the most moving moment was when the tower organization collapsed at a certain time, and she was deeply sad, confused, and depressed, overwhelmed by guilt. And then she said, I hope, Dr. Weiss, you know what you are doing. Now I'm totally depend on you. And that was very, very touching. And actually, I must admit, did not know what I do. So I did not know at that very moment where the analysis would lead us, whether she would sink into even deeper depression or suicide herself.
One can never know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But she was basically saying, as I understand it, that the certainty, if not the companionship that she survived with up till that point, she was able to let go of the addictive attachment to these sadistic objects. She was able to let go of, in the hope, I mean, she must have registered the spirit with which your interventions were being made and what it means for you to tolerate what she threw at you, that she was able to receive it and saw it as more trustworthy ultimately than the concrete sadism of her inner objects.
I think, though, that was a development over the course of 8 years of analysis, but the organization did not entirely disappear. So the men in the tower changed a bit, and they said to her in her fantasies that she was allowed now to have analysis, and which she was not in the very beginning, and to make a better person out of her. but she should not go too far with the change. So it was interesting that parts of this organization survived. But as you say, the addictive dependency had diminished. It was also, she said that she would feel after 8 years that analysis would come to an ending. And she said she should never have said this because she did not want to end. But she could finally, it was a very painful process of mourning that she was able to leave the analysis after 8 years. And so once she said to me, for instance, yes, I feel that I can now try to live my own life, but only if you assure me that we would have material for another 1,000 sessions. Mm-hmm. I said to her, there's no doubt that we would have material for another 1,000 sessions. Mm-hmm. It was very moving because she was really able to leave because she could acknowledge transience and the temporality. It's so often that traumatized patients create endless analysis and they transform the analysis into a sort of psychic retreat, which John Steiner has described.
Yeah, yeah.
The timeless states of mind are one of the big problems of traumatized patients tend to freeze time or to create a longing for a state, a pre-traumatic state of bliss, what Ferenczi had already described. And so they replace in a way her internal organization by the analysis, but they have to be encouraged that they can leave analysis and would not depend from analysis forever.
Does she stay in touch with you?
In the first 3 years, she contacted me 2 or 3 times to discuss a theme with me. And since that time, I have not heard from her. She said she was very sad after leaving the analysis and had a lot of mourning afterwards. But she found it was the right decision. But she would ask me sometimes a question, but I saw her perhaps 4 times in the last 7 years.
You mentioned sadness and mourning, and those are benchmarks, capacities to be able to experience the other with regard, with separateness, with sorrow in an unidealized state. It's also said the splitting is healed, as you write about. Tell us about gratitude, reparation, and how that fits in the development.
Yeah, the first thing I would like to say is that the acknowledgement of guilt is a prerequisite for reparation. There is no reparation without the acknowledgement of guilt. And guilt arises when love and hatred come together toward the same person. There is no need to feel guilt as long as we idealize a good object, and there's no need to feel guilt as long as we hate the bad object. But when we discover that it is the same object and that our love feelings and our hatred are directed toward the same object, then guilt arises. It's more, I think of guilt more as a molecule, not as an atom. And primitive guilt is extremely difficult to bear. It needs to be contained. This is my theory, that the superego can be regarded as a container for guilt feelings. And of course, the primitive superego, which is focused on punishment, like in Mrs. E, her tower organization was a representation of this primitive sadistic superego. As long as punishment is predominant, there is no capacity to work through guilt. But as Melanie Klein said, there is an evolution of the superego from the early sadistic superego to a more helpful organization, which is still sometimes critical, but which contains the guilt feelings of the infant, understands his or her anxieties, and helps him to make reparation. That is Klein's theory. And I think the evolution of the superego is necessary to work through guilt. So if you see the primitive superego, that enhances the repetition compulsion, like in Sisyphus or Tantalus or Prometheus, who are always punished by this cruel god. So the evolution of the superego is necessary to make reparation. And if you can make reparation, then you can develop a sense of gratitude and can... So it's gratitude is the, in a way, the opposite of resentment.
Resentment,
so
yeah.
You can receive something and also acknowledge that this is an asymmetric relationship, because you receive something which you cannot return in the very moment where you receive it.
And that has to be filled with appreciation as opposed to bitterness.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. But so I would say there's the acknowledgement of guilt is a precondition for reparation, and the capacity to make reparation is again the precondition for the experience of gratitude.
Let me ask you about that. You emphasize the presence of guilt. Is that different than saying that you need to acknowledge the presence in oneself and in the other of goodness?
No, I would say that is the same.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. I say that because a sense of goodness and regard for oneself and regard for the other seems more accessible, whereas the notion of guilt, we know what guilt is, but it seems one step removed from a sense of goodness. For example, in my own clinical work and my sense of your writing is what enables us to tolerate the badness that patients need us to tolerate is when we, at the same moment, we, the analyst, can safely, never perfectly, but safely experience our goodness, which means we're not being defined by their badness. It's just something we have to tolerate. But we rely on that. And hopefully in that reliance, we introduce them to that possibility of experiencing our and their goodness.
Mm. So we, in a way, what you say is that in a way we must be able to contain the patient's lost good object.
Yes.
His internal good object. So for some time she or he needs to project it into us to make it, to help it to survive the sadistic attacks from the superego. And when my patient, what you quoted initially when you said, as long as I was bad, I at least knew where I was. And that month he was very identified with her mother, with the mother who was delinquent, who was a prostitute, and who lent her to this pedophilic man. And she felt guilty that her mother was like she was. She said, if I had never been born, my mother would have had a better life. So that was her guilt, incredible guilt, that identification with this bad mother. And later in the course of analysis, she said, I still would hate my mother for what she has done to me. And she had no contact with her mother any longer. Sometimes she said, I think if she had had the possibility to have an analysis at my age, she may have developed differently. Mm. And that was really amazing that she could say this.
That's right. She discovered the goodness that she wanted to share with her mother. There's a tenderness to it.
Yeah, at least she had some compassion with her.
Yeah. Heinz, this is such powerful work and such important work. Tell us a little bit about you. What brings you here? Why this work?
Yeah, I think I worked for a very long time with borderline patients, and that developed from the time where I was a visiting scientist at the Tavistock Clinic and could attend the borderline seminar of John Steiner. And for a very long time, I was in supervision with him, with Hannah Siegel. And that clinical approach, I found that very convincing. And then I found that many of my borderline patients, because I'm also running a clinical unit in a big hospital, a day hospital, psychoanalytic day hospital for borderline patients, many of them reported, of course, this terrible traumatic, cumulative traumatic experiences from their childhood. And I tried to think about how that, and of course the repetition compulsion, how that these experiences repeated themselves. How could one think about this from a Kleinian point of view? And there was not so much written in Kleinian literature about trauma. And so I thought that Klein's concept of reparation, that but does not mean forgiveness to those who have traumatized a child, but reparation of the damaged internal figures. That was, I found that extremely interesting. And so this sort of work developed, and it helped me to really work through those difficult experiences in the transference and counter-transference. Because if we offer ourselves as a good new object alone, that is not very helpful. I found that it's just sustaining the splitting.
Mm-hmm. Do you find the work trying? Trying in a sense of difficult, burdensome, that you take it home more than you do other aspects of your work?
I've got so familiar to work with those patients that's no longer so. We have also the privilege to have a team of very experienced colleagues.
A team is a good thing at these moments, yes.
We could sometimes chat and supervision. I find these patients very moving. Of course, they touch me, and they are challenging, of course, to understand more. As I said, of course, Mrs. E was difficult, but nevertheless, I learned a lot from her. So,
yes.
So it was just because I think that psychoanalytic theory is not finished, it's just open for new discoveries. And the traumatized patients can, there's still a lot which we do not not really understand and have to. So I took too much home of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Heinz, just to remind the listener, the book is Trauma, Guilt, and Reparation, The Path from Impasse to Development. You talk about how you learn from the patients, and that makes it an important experience in your own life. I can tell you that I learned a lot from reading the book. It helped me find more clarity in my clinical work. And I think for our colleagues who work in this realm, they too will learn a lot and hopefully will contribute more, stimulated by your creativity and your courage to write about this.
Thank you very much. We are just at the moment preparing with an American colleague, Susan Finkelstein, a book on claustroagoraphobia, which is also an important area in this traumatized patient, that they can tolerate neither intimacy nor separation. And I hope we will further explore this area. And thank you very much. And I doubted in the beginning whether I should get this book, which had appeared in German, and translated into English, but I am very glad that it received so much attention by my English-speaking colleagues in the States and elsewhere. Thank you very much.
I share your pleasure in that. Thanks so much, Heinz. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, we can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.